Thank you, Chairman Young, board members, and staff. My name is David Costa, and I'm a third-generation member of a family, farming family in the Salinas Valley. Our farm supports the five families of the owners and over 500 employees in several watersheds there. And as a farmer who grows and harvests fresh vegetables through the year, I'd like to give my perspective on several areas of the draft waiver and talk about some of the things we do that are common to many growers. The first comment I want to make has to do with the complexity of Central Coast agriculture, and particularly cool season vegetable production. Our farm, for example, consists of 38 individual ranches, which vary in size. Some are contiguous, some are not. The smallest of these ranches is 5 acres, and several of them are 18 acres in size. The total number of blocks or fields on our ranch is 414, with an average size of 13 acres. Some of these blocks get broken down even farther at planting time for multiple staggered plantings. And as we plant across our ranch, the average size of each individual planting is about 8 acres. We average 2.1 crops per acre per year, and all these crops have differing maturities from planting to harvest. For example, the spinach we grow will vary from just 29 to 40 days from planting to harvest, broccoli from 89 to 140, iceberg lettuce from 66 to 115 days. We currently raise over 20 different crops, and the total number of individual plantings on our farm in a year's time is 1,350. So the point I want to make is, imagine being required to report every fertilizer and pesticide application as a result of this proposal, and imagine trying to understand it as it's reported to you. Multiply it times all the acres in the region, and I believe it's easy to see that any testing and sampling and reporting that's required at a ranch or field level becomes complex and unmanageable very quickly. The amount of paperwork required by this proposal is enormous, requiring so much detail in so many different elements that I believe the amount of time required to be invested in this paperwork by an operator like myself will be measured not in days, but rather in weeks and months. I don't believe there are enough technical experts, certified crop advisors, or other consultants available out there to handle the burden that's going to be placed on growers in this region. I have an example of a particular ranch that we own and farm that I'd like to share with you. This ranch is 107 acres in size, one that we purchased about 4 or 5 years ago, and it's the location of a $200,000 project which we undertook 2 years ago in an effort to contain irrigation runoff. We constructed a catch pond, set aside several acres for tailwater dispersal, and eliminated 4 points of discharge directly into an impacted creek by installing a new underground pipeline to move that water from those points of discharge down to a catch pond at the bottom of the ranch for dispersal of that water on fallowed ground. Now, the definitions in the draft waiver would say I still have runoff from those 4 discharge points because water is leaving the field. Even though no water has left the ranch and it was moved entirely in an enclosed pipeline to a catch pond for dispersal on that same ranch. So needless to say, I believe the definition of runoff should be water that leaves your ranch, not water that leaves your field. Even with this investment of nearly $2,000 per acre, I will still have additional costs of compliance on this ranch because the draft waiver has requirements for a highly detailed farm plan, an enhanced notice of intent, a quality assurance project plan, a nutrient management element to include nutrient budgets, a groundwater monitoring plan, an erosion and sediment management plan, and a riparian function protection restoration plan. When I estimate these additional costs of compliance on this one ranch, the amount of money to be spent on plans, paperwork, vegetative buffers, ground taken out of production, reporting, consultants, registered engineers or geologists, certified crop advisors and employees, it looks like it would cost anywhere between $60,000 and $90,000 on this one ranch in order to comply with the conditions of this waiver. While trying to be food providers and good stewards, these additional costs for compliance sure don't seem like much of a reward for the amount of investment and commitment that we've already made on this ranch, considering that it was the original project and not the compliance costs that will make the biggest impact on water quality there. If I was a tenant on this ranch, I never could have made this improvement with the typical 3-year leases that exist in our valley, because if we were paying for this project only with the profit margins from this ranch, it would take us between 4 and 5 years to pay for this project without any provision for interest expense or taxes. If I was a landlord and this was the only ranch I owned, renting it out to another operator, this project would consume every dollar of rental income for probably 2 years. It only worked because of the size of our operation and improvements that we chose to defer on other ranches in order to take on this one large project here. A small operator or landlord could never have made an improvement of this scale. Our project is providing a very beneficial impact to water quality, but how could anybody undertake several projects like this and the cost involved on multiple ranches in the 2-year timeline laid out by the draft waiver for eliminating irrigation runoff? I'd like to talk a little bit about some other details in the plan which are troublesome. The nutrient budgets required by the plan will be very complex. They will vary widely based on the crop, the differences in the days to maturity that I mentioned, the soil type, the season, and the intended use of the product. For example, a head of romaine lettuce could be harvested at about 3 or 4 different stages of maturity, depending on its intended use. And it could be planted in the same field at several different plant populations and row configurations. Each of these would have different nutrient needs based on that maturity and plant population, which leads to even more complexity. In addition, it's not uncommon for a field to contain 2 or 3 different soil types. So which do you budget for in your nutrient budget, and which do you irrigate for? The erosion control, sedimentation, and stormwater management plan is another area of concern, because this isn't just a situation where you could plant cover crop over the entire valley and show up in April to work after the last rains. If you want to harvest crops in April and May, you need to be planting in December and January and February. If you want to be planting in those months, you need to have beds put up on your ground prior to the winter rains. So it's complicated. Cover crop definitely has its place. No arguments there. But it can never be planted on every field through the entire winter. I don't believe also that every fallow field is like a construction site, because of the deep tillage that occurs in the fall in preparation for the spring crop. The effort to increase irrigation uniformity has existed for decades. I don't believe it's something you can regulate. My first question would be, when would you measure it? For example, satisfactory irrigation uniformity can be achieved with sprinkler irrigation when the wind doesn't blow strongly. However, when the wind does blow strongly, uniformity falls off. We all know that. Anybody who spends any amount of time in our valley understands that the wind can blow strongly for several days at a time, nonstop. In this situation, we can't wait several days to irrigate unless we want to lose our crops, but we do try to minimize the wind's impacts on our irrigation. Properly managed drip irrigation systems can be very efficient. However, improperly managed systems are not. In addition, there are many fields where we cannot use drip irrigation, and there are many crops where we cannot use drip irrigation due to crop quality or economic reasons. Drip definitely has its place. Its place on our ranch is on about half the acres that we farm. In fact, it's common to use combinations of irrigation systems on a given crop, such as sprinklers for pre-irrigation and germination, and drip irrigation after the plants are established. In our operation alone, the investment in irrigation equipment, irrigation systems, and operational and structural improvements over the years in an effort to increase irrigation efficiency and reduce runoff is measured in the millions of dollars, not the thousands of dollars. And I don't think we're atypical when I mention statistics like those. Every truckload of drip tape cost me $50,000. Every truckload of sprinkler irrigation pipe costs $100,000. So imagine what this investment totals when you stretch it across all the operators in the region. Another issue is the buffers being proposed for pesticide applications. Generally, 1/4 to 1/3 of our pesticide applications are made by air because of ground that is too wet or crops that are too large for tractors to enter or for worker safety and reentry considerations. Aerial spray drift is unacceptable and drift off target, but the proposed solution is extreme. On the ranch that I mentioned earlier, the 150-foot aerial spray buffer required along the creek on the north side of our ranch would take 7.25 acres out of production because we could not raise our crops on that portion of the ranch without aerial spray. That would be 6.75% of the ranch, which would be set aside due to the aerial spray buffer. When you add in the acreage where we built the catch pond and spread the irrigation runoff water, we end up with about 11 acres taken out of production on the 107-acre ranch, so it totals over 10%. If you extend that percentage across all of our ranches, it would involve a job loss to about 50 employees. Lastly, I'd like to share with you a few things that we do with regards to fertility and soil testing that I think are common amongst many growers. In the fall, we do a complete soil fertility analysis on each of our blocks in alternate years, so it ends up being once every four to five crops on a complete analysis. We're trying to fine-tune our pre-Cydrus nitrogen testing program. Also, prior to our second crop of the year, we're testing for nitrogen carryover before any fertilizer applications for that next crop. In addition, on one of the 3 to 4 fertilizer applications on each crop, we've placed 2 trials, one where we skipped one application and one where we cut the rate of one application in half. In the trial where we skipped an application, it generally has resulted in an unharvestable crop. And in the trial where we reduced one application by one half, it has resulted in a reduced crop with delayed maturity at harvest time. In closing, this is a big, complicated picture. I believe that in many cases, the goals and especially the timelines of the draft proposal are unachievable. There's no simple solution and no simple practice that solves the problem. In my opinion, it'll be the ongoing mixture of practices with site and grower and crop specific applications, along with the continuing evolution of technology, which will allow the continuing reduction of irrigation runoff and progress towards meeting those standards. That progress towards meeting those goals should be the basis of any plan, with an understanding that this is a problem that was not created overnight, nor will it be solved overnight.
Thank you for your comments.
Hi, I'm Gail Delahant, and I represent Western Growers Association. We have nearly 3,000 members in California and Arizona, 487 of which are in this region. We grow, ship, and pack nearly 50% of the nation's fresh fruits, vegetables, and tree nuts. Also, nearly 80% of the nutritious vegetables and strawberries that are grown in California originate from this area, and they are shipped to the United States. In an interest of time, because we are running out of time, I want to echo the concerns that David just mentioned to you, and I don't want to repeat what he said. But I do want you to know that we are concerned about the aquatic and riparian buffers in the staff report. We're concerned about the 72-hour application of fertilizers. We do use drip irrigation, but we do have tailwater leaving our fields when we have to pre-irrigate for our seed germinations. We are concerned also about the inclusion of the farm plan, and every single solitary time we irrigate, we have to put that in a farm plan. That's going to generate so many pieces of paper, you guys aren't going to know what to do with it. That concerns us. It's a waste of our time. We also are concerned about the farm plan being confidential, and we'd like you to consider those concerns in your direction to staff, hopefully, today. Thank you.
Okay, you still have 30 minutes.
We got lots more. Don't you worry. I'm going to briefly touch on some of the legal issues and flaws of staff's draft waiver. Staff's draft waiver contains stringent new conditions that will subject growers in the region to the most rigorous regulatory program in the state. The draft waiver also contains numerous provisions that are improper, illegal, and exceed the regional board's statutory authority. A few of the numerous legal flaws will be discussed in the following two presentations. CEQA requires analysis of significant environmental impacts and irreversible changes resulting from proposed projects such as staff's draft waiver. Such analysis and environmental review must fulfill the fundamental goals and purposes of CEQA to provide information, public participation, mitigation, and governmental agency accountability. Failure to have an open, collaborative, and transparent process violates CEQA. The lack of detail, supporting evidence, proper environmental analysis, and proper evaluation of alternatives effectively bars the public from providing meaningful and necessary information on the development of a future agricultural discharge program. Such action and inaction by staff has not satisfied the intent of CEQA. Specific violations of CEQA include unreasonable reliance on the 2004 negative declaration, reliance on the 2004 environmental analysis and negative deck in determining that there is no significant effects for the new project is flawed. The contents and scope of the proposed renewal have dramatically changed since 2004 and thus cannot rely on 2004 conditions which evaluated a different issue and a different environment. Staff's draft waiver is a significant departure from the existing regulatory program. It raises far-reaching and new concepts that trigger an entire full-blown CEQA review. In addition, the initial study environmental checklist is inadequate and conclusory in nature. An initial study is the preliminary analysis that the lead agency prepares in order to determine whether a project might have a significant effect on the environment. The task of the lead agency is not to determine whether the project will have a significant impact on the environment, but only whether it might have such an effect. Staff's initial study determination is inconsistent with and violates CEQA. Staff's CEQA environmental checklist determines that any potential results from the project will have no impact or less than a significant impact. Thus, staff determined not to prepare an EIR. However, the lead agency is required to prepare an EIR whenever the proposed project may have a significant effect. Given the various significant impacts, such as those listed on the screen, a full environmental review is required. In addition to not analyzing the significant impacts, staff's initial study fails to disclose the data or evidence upon which the persons conducting the study relied. Mere conclusions simply provide no vehicle for judicial review. By failing to disclose all the data and evidence relied upon, the Regional Board is abusing their discretion and failing to comply with CEQA. The initial study also fails to analyze the significant impacts specific to agriculture. CEQA's Appendix G requires analysis of impacts to agricultural resources in order to protect one of the major principles of the state's environmental and agricultural policy, that is, sustaining the long-term productivity of the state's agriculture. Impacts to agricultural resources are significant environmental effects if the project may convert prime farmland, unique farmland, or farmland of statewide importance to non-agricultural use, conflict with existing zoning for agriculture, involve other changes in the existing environment which due to their location or nature could result in the conversion of farmland to non-agricultural use. The proposed agricultural draft waiver triggers all of these three listed areas. Staff's draft waiver will convert thousands of acres of prime and unique farmland from agricultural production to other uses. Thus, the proposed project significantly affects agricultural resources, and a full EIR must be considered. Staff's initial study also fails to base its decisions on substantial evidence. Staff cannot base its decision on argument, speculation, unsubstantiated opinion, or narrative evidence. Substantial evidence, rather, includes facts, reasonable assumptions predicted upon facts, and expert opinion supported by facts. Reliance on entertainment magazines, such as Gourmet, is unsubstantiated opinion and narration, which cannot be relied upon. Staff has also failed to comply with other CEQA requirements, such as failing to analyze significant environmental impacts and irreversible changes, failure to analyze probable physical changes in the environment, failure to consider a reasonable range of adequate alternatives. Staff must evaluate a reasonable range of feasible alternatives. For each method of compliance, the agency must consider the impacts, mitigation, alternatives, costs, and technical factors. Alternatives must be fully analyzed, disclosed, described, evaluated, and provided in detail to allow the public to provide meaningful comments. This includes the agricultural alternative. Staff's failure to consider a reasonable range of alternatives violates CEQA. Staff has also failed to properly assess all direct and indirect effects on the agricultural environment. This includes the potential loss of thousands of acres of valuable and productive prime farmland via regulatory takings and riparian buffers. Oops. Staff has also failed to consider the significance of social and economic impacts and cumulative effects. Staff's draft waiver will negatively impact agricultural productions throughout the region, resulting in loss of agricultural lands, conversion of lands, and potentially driving hundreds of farming operations out of business. These resulting social and economic effects must be considered in an initial study and full EIR, since they will dramatically change the physical landscape of the region. In addition to various CEQA violations, staff's draft waiver violates provisions of the Porter-Cologne Act. The regional board has the authority to regulate dischargers to furnish monitoring program reports. This authority is not without constraints. Burden, including costs of these reports, shall bear a reasonable relationship to the need for the report and the benefits to be obtained from the reports. Additionally, the regional board has the burden of explaining to each discharger the need for the information and identifying substantial factual evidence that supports requiring these reports. The regional board has simply not met this burden. There is no nexus or reasonable relationship between the proposed monitoring and reporting requirements, including extensive individual on-farm monitoring and groundwater monitoring, and the regional board's need for this information. Since the burden does not bear a reasonable relationship to the need, the monitoring and reporting requirements are unlawful and violate the Water Code. There are also various violations with the Porter-Cologne regarding intellectual property, trade secrets, and proprietary information. Staff's draft waiver expands the nature, scope, contents, and use of farm plans. Requirements now include additional reporting, including detailed management practices and implementation practices. Information within the farm plans contains intellectual property, trade secrets, and proprietary information, much of which has no correlation or nexus to the regional board's authority to regulate water quality. Such data cannot be made public and must remain confidential. Through express language, the Water Code explicitly provides protection to growers for intellectual property, trade secrets, and proprietary information, and calls for such information to not be made public. The Water Code states, the portions of a report that may disclose trade secrets or secret processes may not be made available for inspection by the public. Thus, the regional board must acknowledge that farm-specific information, including pesticide application, irrigation practices, crop rotations, and best management practices, are intellectual property and must remain confidential. There are also various violations in the dictation of management practices. The regional board does not have the authority to mandate specific practices to be used on the field to reach the applicable discharge goal. Nor does the regional board have authority to require an act which is unrelated to the discharge of waters of the state. The Water Code states, no waste discharge requirement shall specify the design, location, type of construction, or particular manner in which compliance may be had with that requirement. Thus, the regional board has no statutory authority to require specific management practices such as IPM, crop maintenance, vegetative covers, and riparian buffers. Rather than dictating overly prescriptive requirements, which it legally cannot do, the regional board should maintain the focus of the goal of improving water quality instead of prescribing how a grower achieves that goal. As already discussed, there's various issues with the farm plan. Staff's draft morphs the farm plan in an unworkable document, and instead of making farm plans into a speculative plan that will not contain useful information, the regional board should maintain farm plans as currently used. Finally, with nurseries. Nursery-specific requirements are not supported by any evidence. The regional board fails to properly support the requirements specific to nurseries, and it does not bear a reasonable relationship to the burden.
Hang on 1 second. I had a couple of questions for you. If you could back, and I've stopped the clock, if you could just back up a few slides. Keep on going. Keep on going. Hold on right there. Okay. Is the conversion of ag farm, is that what is driving this?
Driving
your,
what?
Your CEQA concerns?
No. Okay. It's one small portion with CEQA in compliance.
When you mention ag conversion, what is it that you foresee is going to cause that? Is it the buffer zone requirement?
The buffer zones, and also the very fact that the waiver will be passed. As currently drafted, it's so onerous and will cause numerous farms to go out of business, and therefore that land will no longer be used as ag.
The cost, the buffer zone requirement.
The cost and the generic infeasible nature of the requirements just flat out will not allow someone to continue farming their land.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Of course, one lawyer is never enough. My name is Tess Dunham. I'm with SOMAC, Simmons & Dunn, and I'm here representing the Grower Shippers Association of San Luis and Santa Barbara Counties and ag community, and have worked with this group overall as a whole. There are a couple other legal issues we want to address that we think are really important to make sure that the board is fully aware of, and as I know most of you are. For us, it's always important to remember the policies behind Porter Cologne. When this law was adopted in 1969, the legislature had a very well thought out, balanced law, and it requires that you regulate to the highest degree that is reasonable, and that is reasonable considering all of the demands being placed upon the water. So ultimately, whatever decision you make as a board, you must be able to contend that the action is reasonable and considering everything, including the impact to the local agricultural economy. The waiver provisions in the Porter Cologne also say that the waiver must be in the public interest. Public interest, obviously, is a very broad category, but the public interest does include the impact to the agricultural economy locally. I want to talk about the estimate of cost because Abby did a great job already carrying out and talking about what the cost of this program may be to agriculture, but you do have a mandatory duty to estimate the cost of the program. You must adopt that estimated cost into a basin plan as a basin plan amendment prior to implementation of this program. And I haven't seen yet in the regional board staff's process where they have planning to do that. Maybe they do, but it hasn't been spelled out yet. And I think it's also important to know, I did go back and I looked at the legislative history of this provision, and when you look at the enrolled bill report, as it was written by the State Water Board when this amendment was passed in 1976, it specifically said that the cost is a material consideration for this board. Often we say, yeah, well, I considered the cost and I decided that the cost isn't that big, or I'm not so sure that, you know, it's that big of a deal, or I've considered it and that's enough. It is a material consideration. If the cost of this program cannot be borne by the agricultural community, then this program is not reasonable under Porter Cologne. I think I want to also talk about a few specific requirements within the preliminary draft order, because we've talked a lot of generalities today, but there also are some very specific requirements that we really haven't touched on, and I want to touch on a few, and I won't go into great detail, but I think it's important to really understand that this program as currently set up has end-of-field effluent limits. In your preface to Tables 1A and 1B, it says you must monitor in the discharge water to determine compliance with certain water quality objectives. That, as you all know, is a point source effluent limit. Nowhere within this preliminary draft order does it explain that. It doesn't talk about it, and it doesn't talk about the cost of complying with those end-of-field limits. And you, in a WDR, you would consider that under 13.263. It's not being done here, and we contend if that is the intent of the staff, is to have end-of-field limits, then we need to call them that, and we need to treat them like that, and we need to consider them in that fashion, and not use it in a preface hidden to a table. We need to call it out and be honest about it. And let's talk about some of the water quality objectives. Within that table of water quality objectives, there is the standard list of those that are contained within your basin plan, which are appropriate to identify. But there are also a number of water quality objectives that are called indicators of the narrative objectives. And what it has done, it is taken and put into this table saying that the receiving water must comply with these indicator numbers. These numbers are not adopted water quality objectives. You have never considered them as a water quality objective. You have never considered the economic impact of those. You have never considered if they are reasonably achievable. And I doubt that you have even ever talked about them as a board. And I think that that is wrong. I think that if there's going to be water quality objectives that we are all held accountable for, then they need to come before this board as an amendment to the basin plan and be adopted as a water quality objective straight up, instead of being called an indicator of a narrative. And let's get some examples of those. Here we have, you know, we've talked a lot about the drinking water standard for nitrate today, which your staff used the NO3-45, but as nitrate, the standard is 10. Within this table of objectives, there is an indicator for the narrative biostimulatory substances, which would put the nitrate value applicable to surface waters as 1 milligram per liter nitrate. Now, one note, the table itself doesn't say that the value is as nitrate, but I am assuming that it is because in the regional board staff's justification to the state water board for its 303D list, it identifies this number as 1 milligram per liter as nitrate. That is 10 times lower than the adopted drinking water standard. So we aren't just talking about drinking water standards, we're talking about requirements that are required to be met in the surface water that are 10 times below the standard that you as a board have never considered. The same goes with some temperature objectives for cold and warm habitats. There are specific temperature ranges that this board has never considered and adopted as a water quality objective that is being called an indicator of a narrative objective. We've heard a lot about some of the buffer requirements, and I won't go on a whole lot, but as you all know, you know, the waiver does propose specific buffer requirements to protect aquatic habitat ranging from 50 to 100 feet. Well, you know, clearly in our mind, this does constitute a taking. A taking occurs if it unreasonably impairs the value and use of the property, and it interferes with investment-backed expectations. Well, these buffer zones may violate buyer specifications for food safety purposes, which would not only make that buffer area unmarketable because you're no longer farming in it, but because of its existence, it may make that whole crop or field unmarketable to a buyer. So therefore, it does interfere not just with the buffer area, but far beyond the buffer area when you're dealing with buyer specifications. And let me state that the preliminary draft order specifically says that You cannot take out a buffer for food safety purposes. I mean, it has a specific requirement in there that basically pits food safety and buyer specifications directly against the agricultural waiver. I would also contend that Carrie already talked about dictating a manner of compliance. Any type of prescriptive requirement that says exactly how you must protect aquatic habitat, such as a specific buffer zone, is going to become dictation of a manner of compliance. And lastly, on this issue, Fish and Game has the authority to deal with stream beds, banks, channels, and what can be done as far as clearing in a stream bed. It is not up to the regional board to make that requirement in this preliminary draft order. All of that should be deferred to the proper regulatory agency, which is the Department of Fish and Game. Similarly, within this order, there are specific mandates that mandate the use of integrated pest management by growers and mandates buffers for pesticide use. Again, this authority is specifically restricted to the California Department of Pesticide Regulation under state law. First of all, neither the Department of Pesticide Regulation cannot mandate integrated pest management. That is a voluntary choice by farmers, probably a very good one and probably one that many do employ, but it is still a voluntary choice and not something that can be mandated by the regional board through this draft order. Nor does the regional board have the authority to set buffers for pesticide applications. That is totally within the authority of the Department of Pesticide Regulation. And the Department of Pesticide Regulation is currently working on draft regulations to protect aquatic areas from pesticide drift. They're working on it. I encourage your board to be a part of that process instead of to trying to do it on their own individually here. And again, that dictates the manner of compliance.
Okay, so we'll wrap up here with our proposal. We appreciate the time that you gave us today. We thank you for the opportunity to present our thoughts and ideas regarding the renewal of the conditional ag waiver here in Region 3. As you recall, agriculture was asked to present an alternative proposal to you and your staff by April 1st during your board meeting held last December. Agriculturalists were and are seriously concerned with a lack of process regarding the waiver renewal development and request that you direct any future collaborations from staff to be more open and transparent. Under the leadership of the seven county farm bureaus within Region 3, along with the State Farm Bureau, the agricultural community came together in 3 short months and drafted the agricultural alternative proposal. We would like to work openly with you and develop a long-term irrigated lands program to deal with the long-term issues of water quality on ag lands here in Region 3. This would ensure consistency and avoid changes in the program every 5 years. The long-term program should be reviewed by your board, staff, and the agricultural community every year, and broad-based support from agriculture is crucial to the viability of this program. To move this process forward, we need you, Mr. Chairman, and your board to direct staff to use the agricultural alternative as the basis for the renewal of the conditional ag waiver or a long-term irrigated lands program. Set aside staff's rigorous regulatory program that does nothing to improve water quality here in Region 3, and begin to work collaboratively and openly with agriculture so that together we can ensure the success of an irrigated lands program that focuses on water quality improvement, just as we did with the initial ag waiver process in 2004. With that, I think our panel would be happy to answer any questions at the appropriate time, and we thank the board for their consideration.
Thank you for your presentation. Any questions from the board? Dr. Hunter? Dr. Jeffries? Okay. Thank you very much.